All right, gentlemen, my clock shows 6 o'clock, and thank you for coming out tonight. Thank you for rejoining us for another edition of Masculine Christianity. I was born in 1960, which makes me old, and so I was born at the very tail end of the baby boomer generation. The baby boomers were defined as the babies born to those men coming back from either World War II or the Korean conflict. My dad was actually in the Korean conflict. So the baby boomer generation are all the babies that were born to all the returning men coming back from war, basically. And technically, the baby boomer generation ends in 1964. So my brother, who's 4 years younger than me, was born at the very tail end of the boomer generation. Now, I tell you that because it is my experience to have grown up during what Garris refers to in chapter 1 as second wave feminism. The second half of this chapter involves the issue of second wave feminism. And so I had the privilege of living through this period of time. And although I was, of course, quite young during the sexual revolution that took place in the middle to late 1960s, I do remember its ramifications as I was going into high school in the 70s and the kinds of things that were now being expressed in terms of sexuality in that particular time frame. So I do have a bit of experience here, which is why I find the second half of this chapter to be so very interesting to me. And hopefully, by the time we're done tonight, it will be helpful to you and interesting to you as well. Because I think what Garris does, if I might just be so bold as to express an opinion here, is that he really wants us to be sure we understand what it is we're dealing with here. Okay, we need to understand what the issue is in terms of going forward to a masculine Christianity. Sometimes you have to know what your opponent is all about before you can address what it is you're trying to deal with. So Garris starts his book by laying out very simply for us what it is that we are up against as men in this culture, in this day, today, in the 21st century, what it is we're dealing with. We need to know what it is that we're up against. So what tonight we're going to talk about is second wave and a little third wave feminism that he throws into the chapter, and then some of the other realities involving those particular movements and how they affect us. Second wave feminism, then, is a movement that started, as I said, in the 1960s. It was spurred on, by the desire for the first wave feminists to continue, where the first wave feminists had left off. The first wave feminism had been quite successful in the sense that it had focused on advancing equality for women politically and socially, moving women out of the position of being subordinate to husbands as sort of a what they would call a second class gender, a second class sex, in the area of legality and social realities, particularly, of course, with the right to vote and the right to be involved in the political discourse of a nation. Okay, so first wave feminism found its way into America by the early 20th century, and as the middle part of the 20th century unfolded, that movement had to deal with, obviously, two world wars that took place, and then you've got other conflicts like the Korean conflict and even the Vietnam War. And so first wave feminism had sort of come to its logical conclusion in terms of what was being attempted. But now a second wave rises up in the 1960s to expand on the initiative that was brought by those first wave feminists, to initiate, to bring in, to expand a woman's rights in a number of particular areas. One of them was the right to initiate a divorce, meaning the right to be able to sue her husband for divorce in a legal sense, so that a woman could now make claim to divorce, which has resulted in, of course, the proliferation of no-fault divorce proceedings. To establish the inherent right for a woman to abort her unborn child, again, as a result of the freedoms, quote-unquote, that are contained in the sexual revolution. I'll come back to that in a second. And a push for equitable wages between the genders. Second wave feminism then jumped off of the sexual revolution, which ran, I think, parallel to it, to try to advance the status of women from beyond just having certain legal rights to actually move women into a place where they would have these kinds of opportunities. Opportunities to divorce, opportunities to abort a child, opportunities to receive an equitable wage for equitable work, etc. That was the goals. Now, Garris in the book, of course, calls that a much more radical movement. And rightly so, because what you see happening is the attempt by feminists to push women away from a life centered around the home to a life centered around the workplace. The goal was to push women into a position where they would now be more inclined to see their net worth or self-worth in the workplace rather than in the home. The first wave feminists had accomplished the idea of getting women a voice, but second wave feminism was designed to push women further into the world of men in such a way that, in many ways, as Garris puts it, that they would not only be independent from men, phase one, but they would now begin to act like men in phase two. The goal was to say, you are, as a woman, you are not limited to just living in the home and being involved in that particular enterprise, but now you are free to go and live in every aspect of society, especially into the world of men in the workplace. My own mother, and I've just recently learned some of these things since my dad has died, my mother has become much more open about some of the things that happened in our early life. I now know, for example, that the reason why there's a four-year difference between me and my brother is because my mother wasn't so sure that they were going to make it as husband and wife, which I never knew. But she's been more open about that. She has told me that when after I was born, apparently, she took a job for a brief time because she wasn't sure about what future life would be. And that seemed odd to her. It's like she grew up in a world in which women were called to be wives and mothers and raise their children, and there was this new pressure to work, in a sense. Now, my dad never pressured her to do that, apparently, but she found it a necessary thing, at least for a brief time, and then she decided to be a full-time mom. So this is the kind of thinking, you see, that's being imported into the world in that time frame. I mean, that we're talking, for me, that would be the very early 60s. But even then, you're starting to see the beginnings of it that is floating up into the world. Now, as I said a minute ago, I think that the sexual revolution runs on a parallel track to this feminism. There are overlaps, and there's a certain sense in which the two are together. But there's a sense in the children born in the baby boomer generation of a new way of thinking, particularly about sexuality. It isn't the parents of the boomers, it's the boomers themselves who become the engines of this new sexual thinking. Because if you think about it, you push dads who come home, say, after World War II or after the Korean conflict, like my dad, are having children and they're coming to the age of sexuality by the time you get to the mid-60s. Just in terms of the math, they would be coming to that age of beginning to explore sexuality. So the sexual revolution, which breaks out in the mid part of the 60s and continues into the 70s, was a movement that was designed primarily to push sexual activity out of under the umbrella of marriage. Up until this point, sexuality was largely considered to be a part and a function of marriage itself. Now, yes, there was always the underground sense of sexuality outside of marriage. It's always existed in the human race. But culturally speaking, there was a sense in which marriage was the foundation of a relationship in the bedroom. Okay. But the idea of the sexual revolution was to push that out of marriage, to become something that anyone could participate in without the constraints of a legal connection between the partners. Now, you will notice how this flows. you have this idea of we could just have sex without having to have a legal connection between us, i.e. marriage. At the same time, you got feminists who are suggesting we need more than just a legal kind of separation from our husbands. We want to be able to have equality with them in every sense of life. So the two are running parallel, overlapping with each other in the sense of with the sexual revolution comes more impetus for this push for this legal equality between men and even this idea of being able to do anything a man can do, quote unquote. So the sexual revolution becomes this movement that you could have unfettered, or today we would call it casual sex. And you could think of it now primarily as a recreational activity rather than a procreative one. If you take it out of the realm of marriage, it becomes a recreational activity rather than becoming a procreative one. In the mid-60s, it was still well understood that, you know, if you're going to have a baby, you need to have it in wedlock. Now, I realize today, forget it, that's gone, as we see all around us. But in the mid-60s, and even into the early 70s, when I was, you know, when I was about to enter high school, you didn't have a baby out of wedlock without being shunned by society. It was still very much a part of it. But what the sexual revolution wanted to do was to give you the freedom to be able to participate in sex in a casual sort of relationship. But the need, of course, was for some sort of way to prevent the thing that sex does, which is to create babies, all right, which, of course, is the coming of the pill, female oral contraceptives. So the pill helped to advance the ideology. I personally think it's wrong to think of it backwards, that to think of that the other way. I think it's wrong to say that the pill ushered in the idea of recreational sex. I think recreational sex was already on the minds of people, and the pill came along and maybe even was invented for the purpose of allowing for this kind of recreational activity. Because we have to obviously prevent the one thing that becomes the consequence of this. The main point of sex then became personal pleasure. The pill could reduce or eliminate the consequences of the act itself, of course, but the main ideology was sex as something you did that was just fun. And the hippie movement is very much a part of this kind of thinking. For those of us old enough to remember the hippie movement and the free love movement. You remember the Jesus movement, the free love movement. It was all about this idea of unfettered personal pleasure, the ability to do what you want to do. Notice it's not the parents of the boomers that are into this. It's the boomers themselves. It's the generation that was raised up after these men came back. So this sexual revolution movement had dramatic effects on American culture. Okay? And we're still dealing with the ramifications of this today. Think about these kinds of things. First, the sexual revolution obviously created open questioning of monogamy and the traditional gender roles. The idea of one man and one woman for life in a sexual relationship, particularly in a legal sexual relationship called marriage, was now being questioned. I mean, do you really need a husband to have sex? Do you really need a wife to have sex if, in fact, sex is just a recreational activity? It created in the culture this questioning of the very idea of marriage itself. Well, if you extend that now to where we are today, some 60 years later, here's what you have. You have a whole society now that has embraced that question, the answer to that question, with a whole scale, well, no, you don't. There's no need for husbands and wives anymore, which is why we see a collapse of marriage rates in this country and the proliferation of sexuality in every imaginable way. Additionally to this became, of course, the rampant proliferation of pornography. Pornography became the instrument by which this kind of thinking could be pushed along. Pornography became the means by which this could become. Look, Hugh Hefner and... that's one of them. I'm thinking the guy from Penthouse. I can't think of his name. I used to know it. Sorry? No, that's Hustler. I was thinking Penthouse. Most of these guys in here are like, who? And what are you talking about? Right? Because nowadays, you know, pornography is no longer just found in glossy magazines hidden behind the counter at the 7-Eleven. Now you can, you know, get it in every imaginable way. But you will notice that pornography began rising dramatically in this particular period of time. I mean, when my parents were in their teen years, the idea of, you know, readily available pornographic imagery was almost unheard of. It was available, but it was very much underground, and it was far less than what we see today in terms of its visuality. But by the time you get to my high school years, now you've got respectable, quote-unquote, pornography. You've got Playboy and doing its, you know, interviews, and people, the big joke is always, well, I just buy it for the articles, sort of thing. You know, that was the joke. But you will notice where it sits. It sits within the framework of now pushing this narrative, this ideology, that sex isn't about marriage. Sex is just about pleasure. It's just about fun. It's just about, you know, enjoying yourself. So you have that. Obviously, also, we saw from the sexual revolution the effect of the steep rise in abortion. The Roe versus Wade decision was in 1973. I'm 13 years old when that decision was handed down. I mean, you're really at the height of the sexual revolution when Roe v. Wade was put into place. And I am convinced, have been convinced from those days, that the decision itself was created out of whole cloth by those justices to defend the sexual revolution. That's what they were doing. They were saying, that's right, we as a culture have come to embrace the idea that sex is nothing more than recreational activity, the consequence of that being babies, and so we need to give women the right to destroy the effects of that now recreational activity. So you have a steep rise in abortion taking place, often as a form of birth control. You have the rise in single-family homes. Now, where this particularly comes into play with the sexual revolution is homes where fathers no longer see themselves as responsible for the children they produce. Okay, so it's not just women. We like to blame this on women having sex, but it's also, I think it's more on the male side of this equation, of men who now see sexuality as, well, nothing more than recreational activity. And so I hooked up with this girl. Well, she gets pregnant, so I give her $50 and send her on down to the abortion clinic. And if she doesn't want to do that, then she can go have the baby and go live by herself and figure it out. I mean, some of the popular movies of the 1980s were specifically designed to help mainstream the issue of abortion in single family and or single parent homes. There's a number of movies that I could quote that deal with this particular issue specifically. So this new rise of single family life was a consequence of all of this. Additionally, delayed marriage and family life, which goes along with what I just said a moment ago, and this, I think, is one of the most important things that Garris really doesn't mention, I don't think, but I added it to the list, and that is the diminishment of sex as a good gift of God to be the central act between a husband and a wife. The change in which now sexuality becomes the means through which a whole lot of other things take place. Advertising based on sexuality and based on sex. The diminishment of women, particularly, to sexual objects. The deification, the almost deification of the idea of sexuality in popular mainstream entertainment. You think about so many of the sitcoms and so forth that came out in the 1980s and 90s. They were designed to deal with the whole, or and not only TVs, but movies that were the whole, you know, coming of age kind of movie where you have teenagers that are experimenting with this new world of sexuality. I mean, I could give names and I don't want to because it might tempt you to go and actually watch one of these films. But there were a number of them I specifically remember growing up that were specifically and purposely put in to this idea to simply objectify the idea of women as nothing more than objects to be pursued for this recreational activity. The diminishing of sex itself as a good thing given by God to be a part of the marriage relationship that God himself had established from the very beginning. So once you start with public education being fundamentally secular in nature, which by the early 70s it was becoming, I mean, I graduated from high school in 1978, and by 1978, the idea of prayer in school, gone. The idea of any sort of religious instruction in school, gone. The issue of, you know, the ability to actually have a course on the Bible as a part of the literature classes in school, gone. Okay, even by the 1970s, this is gone. Once you get the secular education and the combination of that with the whole sexual revolution idea, the idea of sex as simply recreation, the objectification of women, you open the floodgates to now a culture that is fundamentally spinning on sexuality. And that's what it does, even to today. In fact, a whole lot more. Because I think, if I might be so bold, is to suggest there's been another sexual revolution that has come in the 2000s. And it's come with the advent of the internet. It's created a whole new world. I mean, where do the vast majority of men and women now hook up? It's online. It's electronically. And pornography has become so utterly rampant that at times you can barely read a typical secular newspaper online without getting bombarded with sexual images and links taking you off to, you know, sites with images in it. That's why you should always install an ad blocker on your browser and eliminate about 99% of that junk from coming to your eyes, even as you're just reading through normal stuff. So the sexual revolution, I think, is a parallel thing to second wave feminism. And I think that what Garris does here is he tries to describe the difference between the two movements in this way. First wave feminism's goal was to make women independent from men, that they'd be able to not only vote and have a say in the political realities of the day, but they would also be able to now seek ways of supporting themselves in whatever role and way that they deem fit, outside of the traditional roles of domestic motherhood. Second wave feminism, then, seeks a more radical goal, to make women possess the desire to act like men. That's, if you watch the book carefully, if you read chapter one carefully, you see this is where Garris is laying his indictment. His indictment with second wave feminism is that the movement is designed to turn women into men, to make women into men, and then, by extension, to turn men into women. All right, that's really where this is going. Second wave feminism, he says, sought a more radical goal, to make women possess the desire to act like men. With the advent of technology, the advancements of the Industrial Revolution, women were now able to prevent the central reality of their biology. They were able to prevent the central reality of their biology. And what is the central reality of their biology? To conceive and bear children and support them. To feed them from their own bodies after they're born, right? That's their central biology. The very reality of what a woman is formed by God to be was the one thing that Adam didn't have, which is the ability to produce children. It is not good for Adam to be alone. Why not? Well, because he doesn't have the necessary parts to actually conceive and bear and feed a child from his biological nature. The sexual revolution changes the purpose of sex, and also, by virtue of technology, now prevents women from actually embracing the very thing they were formed to be. Now, of course, if you say that in front of a typical woman today, she'll lop your head off. But that's because the point that Garris is making is right. This is what has been inculcated into the minds of the American culture today, that the biology of women is, in fact, the same as men. See that? So this is the logical conclusion. The logical progression of this line of thinking is not only are women supposed to act like men, but they are ontologically like men. We can deny their utter biology. Now, if you're a thinking man like I am, you probably stop and go, yeah, but there's still some differences between us, and it is those differences that form the very basis of the sexual revolution. I'll put it like this. Which of the two genders uses pornography more? male or female? And the answer all of us in this room know is men, right? Men use pornography at a factor of 10 higher than women. Why? Because men are fundamentally creatures of vision. We see what we find attractive. Women find what is attractive through emotional connection and other ways, which pornography doesn't give them. But men are visual. So, interestingly enough, the very biological differences between men and women are the very thing that drives pornography. Yet it is that very thing that is denied by the feminists. You would think the feminists would be the first group of people to stand up and say that pornography is the one thing we don't want, because what pornography does is actually establish that biological difference. Makes it very clear, visible, and obvious, correct? And so the point being that there's this sense in which this technology has taken women to a place where they can prevent that which is very inherent to their nature. Thus, they can pretend that they are men, even acting in ways in which they are like men. They don't produce children in the midst of the act that creates children, typically, either through the pill or through abortion. But their biological difference hasn't changed. So there's this fundamental problem. Now, the consequences of the technology then that push in this direction are numerous also. The loss of motherhood, where mothers or people who have children, see, I said it the way that you have to say it today, right? Women who have children can now take their children and pass them off to somebody else to raise them while they go and do the job of a man. Because that's what a man would have to do, theoretically. So a woman can do that now, too, with the rise of daycare and other kinds of things. There also, unfortunately, and Garris speaks of this a number of times in the book, women being forced outside of the protection and provision of marriage to care for and defend themselves. I mean, look, if you're going to be a man, be a man. It's your responsibility to provide for yourself. It's your responsibility to defend yourself. One of the reasons that my mother got a job, as I said earlier, was because she was afraid of what might happen if she and my dad split up. She would be required to take care of herself. And so she wanted to have some skills. She was not a college graduate. She wanted to have some skills. In those days, you could be a part of a steno group, you know, and learn how to take shorthand and learn how to type and those sorts of things. And you could build up a skill, and eventually you could potentially use that. Well, she was afraid of what might happen if she and my father divorced. What's the reality? She's thinking along the lines of how everybody else was thinking in terms of, well, I don't need a husband, but if I don't have a husband, guess what? It's my responsibility then to provide for myself, and it's my responsibility to protect myself. And then, of course, also the loss, and this one I pointed out last week, and this is the one that's most disturbing to me, is that in this new situation now, where second wave feminism pushing women to be like men, I wonder how many of us have really noticed the loss of femininity in the world, where it almost seems like women, even women who belong in Christian circles, no longer think of themselves in feminine ways anymore. Femininity itself, the whole idea of presenting yourself as a woman, not as an object to be, you know, pursued after, but a genuine kind of femininity, the kind that the Bible speaks of, or the proverb writer speaks of a woman whose charm is on the inside, not on the outside, but you know that that person standing there is a woman. It's not a man, in the sense of that sense of true femininity in there. It's kind of lost. I think, for example, of hairstyles. You think of the hairstyles that came out of the 1970s and 80s. Some of you are too young to know that. But the kind of hairstyles that were becoming popular in the days when I graduated from high school were the kind of hairstyles that were common to boys rather than girls. And then you saw a reversal of that trend for a brief time in the 1990s, where there was a strong push back against that in longer hairstyles and things like that. But you don't see that today, do you? You don't see that today. These are all, in my opinion, the consequences of the distinction between first wave and second wave feminism is what it's trying to do. And I think Garris is arguing very much so in this book that the second wave of feminism has created many of these kinds of problems. So you add into that the advancement of technology. Now, the Industrial Revolution, as you know, is a function of the 19th century, not the 20th century. Okay. But the 20th century is where the Industrial Revolution was pushed to its extremes. It's the 20th century where we took the idea of technology and ran with it. Okay, where we actually took the ideas of mass production and electronics and so many other things that were pushed forward. I mean, you think about computers in the 1980s as compared to today. I mean, when I first started in the computer industry, we were using 16-bit processors that filled an entire room for about 8 or 9 people that shared terminals off of it. And it was slow and it was, but we thought it was cool because it was great. You know, you had a disk drive about this big. It was portable, but it was about this big, 20 megabytes. I mean, that card in that camera has 128 gigabytes. The number of those platters to fill that space would take up this entire church building. Would take this entire church building to fill up that amount of space. That's what it was like. But then it began to advance. I mean, you think about air travel advancement. You think about so many things that went so very fast in that era. But those also advanced into the home. There were so many other things that came up which helped to foster second wave feminism, to push it along, to help women feel like they could go into the workplace and compete with men and be men in many different ways. I mean, you didn't have to grow your own food anymore. You could go to the grocery store and buy virtually anything that you wanted to eat, or you could go to a restaurant, virtually any kind, and eat. You didn't have to mend your own clothes or make your own clothes. You could just buy them from a retail store. You didn't educate your children anymore. They didn't stay at home. You sent them to the state-sponsored secular school, and they would educate your children for you. And of course, the daycare systems were also designed to help foster the younger children. By the way, if you haven't figured it out, the whole idea of free daycare coming out of the Democratic Party today is to continue to advance this ideology. We want you to be able to leave your kids with somebody else. Particularly, we want you to leave them with us. Okay? You need to keep that in mind. That's why they're pushing that. We also have now, as we advance this technology, the entertainment of children, the entertainment of the family would no longer be in family-friendly environments. It would no longer be about the family gathering together around the dinner table and eating a meal together and playing cards together or board games together or whatever. But rather now, we would just set them down in front of a TV set and they would eat their rather disgusting TV dinner, I was about to say, in the aluminum foil tray that you had to cook in the oven for like 12 hours, and the middle was always still frozen when you got done, and it was horrible. But you could now do this instead of, and some of you are looking at us like, man, you people really are old. Yeah. But, you know, so anyways, the idea was is that the technology was actually being created, I think purposely, to give housewives more liberality to be able to leave the home and leave their children and go out and pursue after men. The idea of home-cooked meals. I mean, mothers cooking home-cooked meals. That's pretty rare today, isn't it? Sitting around the dinner table at night, that's pretty rare, isn't it? And there's a lot of us oldies out there lamenting that, but here's why it's coming. See, it's coming because of this grand push in society to make women into men, to eliminate the differences between men and women, which is exactly the third wave feminism's goal, okay? When you go to pages 18 and 19 in the book, what Garris is going to describe is third wave feminism, which really started in the 1990s. It's really kind of hard to say when it really started because I think it's, in many ways, third wave feminism could just be called second wave feminism on steroids. It's simply just taking all the basic ideas behind second wave feminism and just pushing them as hard as possible through all of society to advance that second wave ideology. Now, third wave feminism is not monolithic. There's not a single ideology in it. There's a whole lot of fronts and sub-ideologies, but it does have certain common traits designed to advance the causes of women. One of the causes of this movement, then, is the logical outgrowth of the sexual revolution. It's been to push for the celebration of sexuality as a means of empowerment. It used to be as a means of enjoyment. Now it's become a means of empowerment, including homosexuality. Now, this is kind of strange, but follow the logic here. The idea of homosexuality is, in many ways, to empower women in the area of sexuality to do away with men. If, in fact, Gloria Steinem was correct that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, it implies that women don't need men at all. First wave feminism is, well, we want to get out from underneath the shadow of men so that we can at least be equal to men. Second wave feminism, well, we want to be able to be at the same level of them in every part of society. Third wave feminism is, we want to do away with the male sex entirely. Or, probably the better way to say it is, we want to elevate women above the male gender so that women become the primary power holders in society. In other words, we want to go from a patriarchal society to a matriarchal society. And today you watch movies like Wonder Woman, the new one, and you get the very clear implication that this is supposed to be a female-dominated world rather than a male-dominated world. So we're moving very in the third wave, we're pushing very, very hard towards this idea we can do away with men. And homosexuality happens to do that. Lesbianism contends in sexuality that men are not necessary to women falling in love, quote unquote, participating in sex acts together, and even later being allowed to marry, which is a relatively new concept, but nonetheless, here it is, advances the notion that women simply do not need men, that they are superfluous to happiness and fulfillment. There's many women, in fact, who are not lesbians, but who buy the ideology. I don't need a man. What do I need a man for? I'm perfectly capable of going out in the world and competing with men. I can get their jobs. I can earn money like they do. I can do all the things that men do in the world, and I certainly don't need a husband to accomplish that. So you'll notice it went from women being allowed to compete with men on even ground to women now having a position of greater power and dominance. And this is very clear in our current scenario. If you look around, you see it very, very clearly in the message that's being sent by government agencies, etc. This whole movement that occurred since the beginning of the pandemic, and I find that utterly fascinating, that since the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen this massive rise in this push of this ideology. Women need to be given more power and more prestige. And by the way, it should be even to the point now where men want to be women. And women want to be men. We call that, of course, the transgender movement, which is flowing out of this thinking. Now, homosexuality itself, of course, isn't just female on female. By necessity, of course, male homosexuality would also need to be advanced in this ideology. Although it is only secondary to the feminist goals listed above. So as you move out of third wave feminism into what you could call a fourth wave feminism, the advancement of transgenderism takes this to its next logical step. If women are fundamentally equal to men, which is the core ideology, right, then it makes sense that they would literally become a man. Okay, so I'm going to stop dressing in dresses, and I'm going to start dressing in male clothes. You now call me Jean. Spelled differently, but you call me Jean. I want to be a man instead of a woman. With the idea that all persons, regardless of biological sex, are simply the same, then it logically follows that persons with such beliefs would strive to simply change their sex to match whichever one suits their desires. And we've even gotten it now to the point where you can watch mentally unstable people on TikTok talk about the fact that they change genders every hour. Or they use genders that are simply made up out of thin air. Nobody knows exactly what they're talking about. And when I say mentally unstable, I mean mentally unstable. The sameness trumps these contradictions. The sameness trumps these contradictions and allows the two to flourish together as the result of third and fourth wave feminism. I would say, in essence, transgenderism represents the height of human reprobation against God's design for the sexes. Okay? It's a man standing there and shaking his fist at the heavens and saying, yes, I know that you formed me in the form of a man, and I have a chromosomal reality of a man, but I refuse to be a man. That's reprobation at its very height, and I think it's the judgment of God. This feminism, then, that we've been talking about, first wave feminism, and then second wave, and now even third wave feminism, has very much been ingrained into our legal systems. Okay, you need to understand that we are fighting against a very clear sense in which it's been advanced into the entire legal system of America. The universal suffrage that was mandated by the 19th Amendment was followed up then by no-fault divorce laws, now applicable in most states, the use of the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment, now being regularly used by the courts to force gender equality, including the striking down of state laws discriminating against homosexuals. What I mean by that is the sodomy laws that used to be on the books, which made homosexuality a crime. Those laws have been undercut by the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment by the Supreme Court. And, of course, probably the most egregious of these is the ensconcing of the legal right to abortion and the ability to marry someone of the same sex into the very fabric of our nation's law system. Even though both of those decisions, as you will notice, were not established by legislatures. They were established by court systems who simply found them, the right to those, somehow in the framework of the Constitution. As though George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the others that developed the Constitution had any idea whatsoever of those things being the case. They're simply found to be there by twisting the language of the Constitution to these sort of inalienable rights. And I can assure you that the next thing along the line is going to be something having to do with transgenderism. That'll come next. But you're also going to see ensconced into law by virtue of judicial fiat, things like universal health care and other kinds of things. Because once you open Pandora's box to believing that there are inalienable rights found there that were never envisioned by the original founders, look, you can find anything there. You can find anything there. Ironically, it has been the court system itself that has worked to undermine many of the laws designed to protect women. The very laws that were designed to protect women have been undercut by judicial activism, where unelected judges overturned the law to invent, out of whole cloth, new rights that were never there before. And this is most significant to the feminist movement. They've been unable to use the democratic means of passing laws to further their agenda. This culture war didn't take place in the Senate and House of Representatives. It took place in the culture. And it became accepted by virtue of people simply pushing this ideology using the tools and techniques available. I saw an interesting poll today. There was a liberal who came out with this poll in Twitter. He had asked this question: which of the following two has done more damage to America? The right-wing media or the corporate media? Thank you. And the results of the poll, after 130-some thousand people had voted on this Twitter vote, overwhelmingly the corporate media. Right-wing media, about, 14% of the people, and 86% said the corporate media. In other words, the major mouthpieces of society became judicial activists. They became journalistic activists to push this agenda. In other words, all of these kids that came out of the boomer generation were educated in secular institutions and then moved into journalism and politics and corporate America. They moved into these places, they took over positions of power, and they've now rammed that ideology into the culture using those tools. They didn't need legislatures, which is the irony of this. Because what is it what the women wanted to begin with? The right to vote. But they gave up their right to vote in favor of judicial activism to get other things they thought would be better for them. Because the right to vote, they knew, would not get them what they wanted. It didn't take legislatures to get rid of sodomy laws. It took just courts to do so. Which leads us to his discussion of statism. Okay, now this cannot be overlooked. It's part of the reality here. It's part of where we're going, all right? Statism is the political system in which the state maintains substantial centralized control of social and economic affairs. The reality of living in a statism world is that the state becomes the entity through which all forms of social and economic reality passes. Statism is the hallmark of leftism. Leftism is fully of the idea that the state should control the means of production in a society. That's Marxism 101. That the state should control the means of production in a society, particularly through taxation, using its power to determine and dole out what is, quote unquote, best for its citizens, as though government as a bureaucracy of people is able to determine what's best for a society. The individuals in the society then become wards of the state, and the state becomes the one providing for them. All right, in our world today, we already live in a world of statism, okay? Don't think you don't, you do. You already live in a type of government that basically everybody agrees is this. In our current form of statism, the government is the source of all of the following: food and clothing through welfare and food stamp systems, healthcare through government-funded medical systems like Medicare and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, elderly support through Social Security, and other forms of economic need, including Social Security disability and other government-funded entitlement programs. Interesting term for it, entitlement. I deserve this. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people who said, well, I'm going to start taking Social Security when I get 62 because I put that money in, I earned it, it's mine, I want it back. Well, that kind of thinking, my friends, is simply nothing more than statism 101. That's what it is. I'm saying I'm putting myself under the government to become a ward of the government by taking, quote unquote, back the money that I gave. No, you didn't. You gave money through Social Security to support the people currently on Social Security. You were given nothing but an IOU as to your future state eventually, hopefully, in that program at some time. And through all of my life, there has been the continuing message of, well, Social Security probably won't be around when you retire anyways. Ironically, in a strange sort of way, it's still here. Okay. But, you know, politicians find this to be the third rail, so you can't really get rid of it. But that's the point. Statism becomes the state governing life. Government stands to protect its citizens by imposing mandates to certain medical procedures in the face of health emergencies, disguising their advancement under the proviso of what's best for you. Now, anybody know what I'm talking about in that sentence? Well, of course you do. In this system, then, of statism, especially as it grows, family disintegrates, fathers are no longer the primary providers, women no longer need to rely on a husband. Again, notice the whole point. You don't need to rely on a husband because, hey, the government will step in and take care of you. The family relies instead on the financial largesse of government programs. Women no longer need men to support them and their children, and single-parent families proliferate in great numbers. In other words, the government is not in the business of creating families. Quite the opposite. A statism is designed to split up families or recreate it or redefine it in order that it maintains its control over the population. Look, the greatest form of statism in the world, of course, has been communism. It's also the greatest failed form of government that's ever existed on the planet. But nonetheless, it is a form in which the government becomes the entire means of production. And do you think these governments want religion? They want faith? They want families? They want solid bedrocks in society that stand alone independently and work for themselves and protect themselves? No, 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 no. Because that means a loss of power for those at the top of this pyramid scheme. Because that's what it is. Now, I realize that it's very hard to get out from underneath this. As I said, we live in a statist world. Okay, so there's going to be people who are going to say to me from this, okay, you don't understand, I need the Social Security in order to survive. I get it, because this is the world we've created. Okay, I mean, and I don't begrudge them for that, because this is the world in which we live. I mean, I used an Obamacare plan for a number of years and took the government money for the health care plan because it was offered to me. I broke away from it because, number one, I found it unethical, and number two, I found a better way through a health-sharing program with other believers. But so I don't begrudge anybody using it. I realize this is the world in which we live. But we need, as men, to understand what's being pushed down on us from a top-down perspective. Because if we are, as Garris suggests, going to try to recover what it means to be truly masculine, we need to be able to open our eyes, look around, and say, wait a minute, what is it that's got us into this pickle in the first place so that we can be sure that we know how to get out of it for ourselves? Which means we're going to have to maybe make some very difficult decisions about what it means to be connected to government-run programs and so forth. Okay? And that's the point that Garris is making. The loss of masculinity has partly come about because of this new way of thinking about government that's now been ingrained into our way of thinking as Americans. We don't take it for granted anymore. I mean, we take it for granted now. We don't stop and think about, okay, should I be connected to these systems or not? Most people just go, look, I'm turning 65. I'm taking Medicare. I'm going to have Medicare. We just sort of automatically assume that's the case. Sometimes that's okay. I don't think there's anything morally wrong with doing so. What I'm suggesting, though, is stop and step back and think about what this system creates within it. And why is it on the rise? Because the ideology behind it is pushing us in a certain direction. The individual actions themselves are basically amoral. But what's the ideology? That's what Garris wants us to be thinking about. Which also means we need to think about one other institution that this has affected. And that, of course, is the church. First and second wave feminism didn't limit itself to infecting government. It also went after the church. And today we have a form of feminism invading the church as a consequence of that ideology being present all around believers outside of the church. Okay, make no mistake about it. You will be affected by the culture in which you live. And you will bring that culture with you into the church. It is unavoidable. As I've said many times, I get out of your life, if you come here on Sunday mornings only, I get less than 1% of your attention in the course of a week. Less than 1%. 99% of your time is spent outside the walls being affected by everything out there that's coming at you. And of course, the new technology has created the ability for that ideology to be pushed at you right through the little device that you have in your hand. And so that you're being constantly fed the message. I get less than a percent. I get 1 hour out of 168. Do the math. Okay? So this has come into the church. And it's often inevitable that the thinking of the culture will affect the church itself. Look, you cannot read the New Testament letters of Paul without realizing that Paul had to address cultural realities coming into the church. Read 1 Corinthians, right? Paul's dealing with cultural matters that are infecting the way the people are thinking. Feminism affecting the church has caused a number of things. And some of the biggies, of course, are the proliferation of female pastors and the rise of women into decision-making roles in the church, including even elders and staff, particularly in mainline denominations. And I would add to that not only the fact that there are women pastors, but also the fact that in those churches, there's no question ever raised about them being pastors. It's just automatic. In fact, if you as a Reformed Baptist were to walk into a mainline Presbyterian church, sit there while a woman preacher is preaching, and then go up to the main pastor of the church and say, why is that woman preaching? She shouldn't be preaching. She's a woman. He will look at you like you're some sort of foreigner speaking a foreign language. He would not understand your question. He would not understand your question at all. It's in the cult, it's in the church, in the sense that it's in the thinking of the church. Not only that, but we have other kinds of things that have affected the church. Look, the rate of divorce amongst churchgoers mirrors the statistics of the society as a whole. It has for many years. There has been no appreciable difference in the divorce rate between evangelical people calling themselves born-again believers and non. It's been the same for a very long time. It's also, in churches, the nearly ubiquitous acceptance by Christians that it's okay for women to pursue careers outside of the home and to leave the education and care of their children to others. Maybe not so much in this church. But in most churches, there's nobody who stands up in that church and says, Whoa, wait. Why are we suggesting to our daughters that they should go to college, earn a college degree, and then go off and work in the world? No one's asking that question. You will notice that even me bringing it up probably made a few of you uncomfortable because it's like, we don't ask those kind of questions. It's kind of given. But that's my point. That's Garris's point. It's so infiltrated, even the evangelical church, that we don't even question those kinds of things. When was the last time you heard a pastor stand in the pulpit, for example, and say, look, fathers, don't let your daughters go off to college. Train your daughters up to be wives and mothers and find them a husband. Well, that guy get fired like 5 minutes after that sermon. Because it's in the very ethos of the church herself. We don't even question it. It's come here. the ready embrace by many in the church of government financial programs that in and of themselves are often responsible for the very breakdown of the family, as I said above. We just accept these things as a part of, okay, that's part of our culture. We just accept it. And the introduction of now, of course, the far greater problems is now the introduction of the so-called gay Christianity, which is, again, becoming ubiquitous in many parts of Christianity. Those who identify as both homosexual and a Christian, assuming that the two can coexist without tension, right? Now, many of these ideas are being brought into the church by the so-called evangelical feminist, which I find to be an oxymoron. But nonetheless, an evangelical feminist, people who believe, not just women, but people who believe that it is possible to square the theology of Christianity with the worldview of feminism. We can bring the two together somehow. It's okay for us to trust in Jesus and love Jesus and be followers of Jesus, but at the same time to embrace the cultural realities of feminism. Now, you will notice, if you haven't figured it out by now, that this is really where Garrett is hitting the nail the hardest with his hammer. Okay? Make no mistake about it. This is where Garrett is going. Garrett wants us to be very clear that the church herself has been infected by these things. Okay, you and I can argue all day about whether or not the state is what the state is and what the state is doing and what we do with our personal lives. Okay, we can argue about that all day and we can have disagreements about that as good men can. But the bottom line is that the real issue that he's dealing in this book is you and I who call ourselves believers gather together in churches and yet have embraced many of these cultural realities in the very world that we live, which is supposed to be obviously countercultural. It's supposed to be countercultural. It's supposed to be different from the culture because it's a culture of Christ rather than a culture of men, right? Such believe, these evangelical feminists believe, it's possible to continue to hold to the idea that the Bible is authoritative, but also accept the strictures imposed by that authoritative voice are no longer applicable or can be reinterpreted to allow women to rise to the same position as men in the church and home. Now, we're going to have whole chapters for that subject in this book a little bit later on, all right? But for the start, he's indicting the church as being the kind of place where we see this ideology creeping in. And where's it starting? Okay? Where's it starting? Garris implies, maybe he just states it outright, but to me, he implies that the real problem here is where the theology of the church is. The problem is theological. The problem is fundamentally theological in terms of what has been embraced as the primary understanding of God in the church. Okay? And what is the basic understanding in most evangelical circles of the very nature of God? And the answer, of course, to that question is, well, God is love. That little three-word phrase, which, by the way, is biblical, but grossly out of context when it's used in this way, is that God simply is loving, and we must accept the behavior of all people, we must love them, rather than calling them to repentance. Now, make no mistake about it, this was the thought of the liberal school emerging out of the 19th century, infecting the mainline denominations by the early 20th century. Make no mistake about it, you walk into a typical PCUSA church today, typical PCUSA church, and you will hear this message from the pulpit. Our God is a God of love. He loves us the way that we are. He wants us to love Him back. And so that means that we must go out into the world and love humanity as God loves them. In our definition of what love is, of course, we're not talking about this idea of confronting sin, because that's actually unloving. Calling men to repentance, that's unloving. We are to love people as they are because God loves us as they are. Now, you'll notice the nugget of truth in there is that, yes, God does love you in spite of what He sees in you or me, but He loves you too much to leave you in that state. But that part doesn't get spoken of in this whole new theology. The mainline churches then began to rethink the gospel as a message of loving social justice rather than the message of sin and judgment. The message was simply to love others as God has loved us, by pursuing forms of societal change that would benefit the poor and the needy. Now, have you noticed something here? This is what is now being pushed in relatively conservative movements like the Southern Baptist Convention. You are hearing voices throughout the Baptist world, particularly the last bastion of conservative Christianity called Baptist life, and particularly Southern Baptist, where these voices are saying, look, we need to stop focusing on all of this sin and repentance stuff and get to the real matter of loving our neighbors and loving those who are different from us and embracing the idea of social change as the way by which we go about advancing the cause of Christ. Evangelism is no longer about preaching about the need to repent of sin and being converted to come to faith in Christ. Evangelism is now getting people to love Jesus and then solving their other problems at the same time. There are strong voices pushing in this direction, okay? They're simply mirroring what we saw happen in the early part of the 20th century with the mainline churches. What you are seeing happening today in the SBC is identical to what happened in the 1910s and 20s in the mainline churches. It's identical. Different voices and different subtext underneath it, but the same goal. Just love your neighbor. Just love your neighbor. And this includes, of course, treating women as equal to men. That's loving. See, we don't want to tell women that they're second-class citizens, you know, where we relegate them to positions that they're not, or they're not given the opportunities of leadership like men are. We don't want to say that. That would be unloving, you see. See the voice? It's the exact same voice that's being out there in the culture that's now pushing into the church. This is where Garris is indicting. He is saying, listen, the real problem with second wave feminism in particular is that it has come against the church to push the church into thinking like the culture. And the problem is that many churches started doing that a long time ago when they didn't push back against no-fault divorce, when they didn't push back against pornography, when they didn't push back against women going into the workplace and competing with men, when they didn't promote the idea of motherhood and home life, when the church threw in the towel and said, okay, whatever, just do whatever you want to do outside these walls. We're not going to be a moral voice over you. We're not going to go there. So that's where he's going here. So Garris ultimately then comes back to the church and says, okay, you understand the church is being affected by this stuff, all right? So he turns around and he takes out his big gnarly finger. I don't know if he has a big gnarly finger or not, but metaphorically speaking, he takes a big gnarly finger and he points it at you and me. Points it at us and says, you know what? The real problem is us, men. It's our fault. It's our problem. Feminism has invaded society, the home, and the church because men have abdicated their roles to lead. Abdicated their roles to lead women. Since God has ordained men to be the leaders of these institutions, it is logical that the blame for them being corrupted by feminism should fall on their shoulders. There's a part of this book I really don't like, and I've tore those pages out of my book, but it has to do with this whole issue of him blaming pastors for this. I don't think he's right. I mean, after all, you know, pastors must do what their congregations require them to do, right? We don't have any choice in the matter. We get paid by these people, and so we should tell them what they tell us to say, right? I mean, that's reasonable. So if I'm going to be a pastor, then my job is to tell you what you want to hear because you pay my salary and your tithes and offerings, and so that's my job. So don't blame me for the fact that, you know, we have all these problems. Now, somebody's going to cut that out of my audio and spin it back at me and say, So let me be unequivocal here. I don't believe a word I just said. All right? Because I agree with Garris absolutely. The problem falls with men like me. And I'm willing for us, me, to represent pastors. We have been the primary problem. I would argue, and I don't think Garris does this, I'll add this to Garris's book. I think the fundamental problem with pastors has been their inability to actually preach solid theology, resulting in weak-willed men in the church who embrace every wind of doctrine that blows by the front door. The natural effect of that has been their willingness to embrace cultural realities. Then the men who stand as pastors have refused to stand up and point the finger at men and say, stop that. Now, the reason that they haven't been doing that second part is because they don't have the moral authority to do so, because they weren't standing for a solid theological foundation in the first place. Because they didn't teach their congregation the whole counsel of God, the result of that was is that they left weak-willed people. Now they don't really have a choice. They're stuck with them. And evangelicalism finds itself in this reality. So pastors watering down their messages so that the sheep are not affected, hoping that something will sneak in to stem the tide, never works. Never works. I think what Garris is actually arguing here, I don't remember if he says this directly or not, but I'll put the words in his mouth if he's not. It's time for pastors to step up and be pastors. Okay? If he's demanding that men step up and be men, it's also time for pastors to step up and be pastors. Stop preaching watered down theology to a bunch of goats in your congregation, believing that somehow that's going to advance the cause of Christ. It is not. Be prepared to let the goats go. Even if that means you're left with three sheep in your congregation, do what you have to do. Preach the word in season and out of season, even when it's not very well liked by your people. But it is true because it's from God's word. And you'll create strong-willed people who will then be ready, I think, to accept the idea of masculine Christianity. So I would undergird this book by saying you are not going to get anywhere with this book if you take this book and hand it to a bunch of weak-kneed theological people. You might as well spit into the wind, because those people are not going to be ready. In fact, they'll turn on you. I think you take this book into a typical First Baptist church in America today and try to teach this book, they will eat you alive. They'll send you packing. Why? Because they don't have a theology behind. They don't have a worldview. They don't have enough in the knees to be able to actually say, yeah, this is right. Because they haven't been taught anything. So Garris contends that to overcome the infiltration of feminism to the church, men must begin to act like men. Pastors must begin to act like pastors. And Christian men must begin to recapture the masculine message of Christianity and apply it to their homes, their churches, and, as far as we can, into society. Three things are going to be necessary then. Number one, we need to know the masculine message of the gospel. As I just said, that I think is the part that's missing. We haven't been teaching the masculine message of Christianity. We haven't been teaching the idea of God as Father. We've been teaching the idea of God as some sort of lover of us in a purely recreational sense. Now, anybody notice the parallel there? We've been teaching sexuality as the idea of nothing more than personal pleasure. So we've just turned it theologically into the same thing. God just loves us in a pleasure sort of way. Go to God, get your needs met. Go to God, He loves you. If you don't need God, don't worry. He'll be there when you do. Right? Moralistic, therapeutic deism, which now affects almost all churches in America, of this idea that God is somehow out there. He's available when you need Him. And the whole message of Christianity is therapeutic. It's designed to make you feel good about something, and it's nothing more than moralism. It has nothing to do with actual repentance and faith and following Christ. It's just be good and be good at it. So we got to know what the first point is. We better know what the message of masculinity that the Bible truly teaches is. Secondly, then, we must be ready to act, or I'm sorry, we must be willing to consider then, all right? Not only must we know, but we must be ready to consider. What do I mean by consider? We must be ready to say, where have we failed in all this? This is the hard part, okay? I would suggest to you that this second step is far harder than the first. At least at Grace Fellowship, where we have some theological foundation here. I would say that Grace Fellowship, in my own personal estimation of this church and its people, has a far greater depth theologically than almost any other church that I've been in. Okay, agree? Okay. If that's true, the real issue isn't going to be us building a theological foundation. The real issue is going to be for us considering what that means. That's the real issue. And how many of the men of this church, including all of us sitting here and watching by Zoom, how many of us are really going to be willing to consider where we have, in fact, been embracing feminist ideology and don't even realize it? And then, when someone calls it to our attention, like Garris is going to do as this book continues, are actually willing to say, yeah, we've been wrong here. And we need to figure out a way not only to understand what is right, but to teach the women around us what is right. See, it ain't just about teaching yourself what it is. We've got to teach the women too, because listen, they're drinking at the same water fountain that we've been drinking from. They've been drinking from the feminist water fountain for the last 60 years, my entire life. So we're going to have to be the ones who learn these things and then teach it to them. See, I said this wasn't going to be easy, did I? I don't think Garris wrote this book to make it easy. By the way, just as an aside, and I forgot to mention this earlier, our own Travis Brown has actually interviewed the author of this book in a podcast that he'll be releasing soon. I'm looking forward to hearing it. And I think all these guys are as well. So Mr. Brown will let us know when that podcast drops, and I will let you know where it is so that you can listen to it. I'd be interested to hear some of his comments about why he wrote this book and some of the other things that are, because this is a guy who is probably going to need armed guards around his house not too long from now. If this book catches on like I think it might, particularly in some parts of evangelicalism. Look, if there were some women in Robertsdale knowing that we were doing this book, they'd be picketing our front door. But as I told Travis this morning, yeah, but we got enough gun-toting men in this church, we could run them off. They're packing too, yeah, that's right. So, number one, we need to know what the masculine message is. Number two, we need to be prepared to consider what the reality of that's going to mean. That's the hard part, which then we need to put into action. Step three, we need to be ready to make the changes in our lives that we're going to need to make in order to do what needs to be done. We can, in a sense, we're going to need to stop breathing the air of the world around us and start breathing a different one, which is really tough to do, isn't it? Because it's everywhere. It's all around us. And we're not immune just because we have a whole lot of homeschool moms around this church, okay? Because there are other areas that are in need of thinking in this, and we're going to get into lots of them as we go through this book. There'll be a whole lot more stuff we're going to talk about, particularly an understanding of how the Bible presents these sorts of things. But we need to first know, second, consider, and then third, we must act. We must be willing to make the necessary changes. But I'm convinced that what Garris gives to us in the first chapter of this book is an informative, honest assessment of where we're at and why and how we got here. And he's going to continue that thinking in chapter 2. There's questions there for the next lesson coming up next week. He's going to continue the thought, and he's going to move in a slightly different direction in regards to the indictment that he's going to make. But what you're going to see starting in chapter 2 then is the beginning of this consideration process of us thinking of these matters. The indictment itself is not over yet, but we still need to be thinking, what is it that we believe and why do we believe it? So, I don't know about you, but I have so far found even chapter 1 of this book to be radically informative and helpful, because even though I lived through these things, I mean, they've all been a part of my 61-year experience on this planet. I'm not sure I really understood it all. Not really sure that I really understood exactly how this all fits together. But I'm beginning to get a much better picture of why we are where we are. And so that's the first step, right? Know who you are and how you got here. Okay? So, next week, chapter 2, we're probably going to take 2, if not 3 lessons out of chapter 2. I started writing the questions thinking I could get halfway through the chapter and went, no. So you'll see why as you get started into it. There's a whole lot to discuss and it keeps going. So I appreciate your coming and giving me your attention, and I hope that this has been useful to you.